Hey everyone, listen up. Grease is the new copper. If you're a thief stealing someone's air conditioner for the copper wiring, that is so 2007. Sucking used fry grease out of the bin behind the Arby's, now that is where it's at these days.
Ew.
Yeah, I know, it's totally gross.
What?
But useful. Raw grease can be rendered into yellow grease and then made into biodiesel. With demand for biodiesel increasing, the market value of this yellow grease has tripled in the last couple years to 32 cents a pound. That may not sound like a whole lot, but it's about bulk, baby, bulk. In fact, there's been a legitimate grease collection trade for decades now. One of the largest companies involved, it's called Griffin Industries, and they say that, quote, rendering contributes more than $1.5 billion to the GNP annually. So it's been a big business for a long time. There have always been thieves, too, but lately more people are getting into the grease game. We learned about all of this from a report by Ben Arnoldy in the Christian Science Monitor. And when reporters do our homework for us, we call it Ripped Off. From the headlines, Ben is on the line with us now. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Rachel.
Hey, thanks for joining us. So we've characterized this stuff like French fry grease, but give us a few more details. What is this stuff?
Well, it's grease that's collected from restaurants. So whenever they're deep frying something like French fries, it's the leftover gunk in the fry later. And that could be vegetable oil. It could be animal fats.
From any food that's just deep fried.
That's right.
And I understand you visited a rendering plant where this stuff is made into the more valuable yellow grease. Explain that particular adventure. It sounded kind of gross.
Well, before I went, I was talking to a source and said, well, I'm planning to go down to a rendering plant. And they said, oh, do not wear good clothes and wear old shoes you don't care about because the stuff can really smell. And if it gets on you, it's hard to get off.
What does it smell like?
Well, it smells kind of like a combination between a fast food restaurant and a butcher shop where the meat maybe has gone mad, gone bad. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not good. And so when you went to this plant, did you see anything that kind of surprised you?
Well, it's called it was a tallow company. And I don't know if you know what tallow is, but it's scraps of animal fats. So there was some animal parts that I could see, which was kind of gross. But I also, the other thing they do is collect the grease out of the restaurant bins. So the owner there showed me some of the bins that they have, and they're metal bins, and the top cover for a lot of them was bent up.
Hmm.
And that's because they had put locks on the bins, and these thieves, instead of trying to break the lock, they would just bend up the metal of the container and then slip in what they call a stinger, which is the nozzle on a hose, and there's just enough room so that they could sneak the nozzle in and slurp up the fat that's in the bin.
Wow, so they're actually taking it from the rendering facilities as well as the restaurants. Now, the whole thing was pretty much news to us. I had no idea that it was illegal to take this grease. I mean, you would think that this is just waste, that restaurants would actually pay companies to take it away, right?
That surprised me, too. And, in fact, for many years, that's the way it worked, that they would have to pay people to come and get it. But because yellow grease is so valuable now, it's usually done for free, or even in some cases, the collectors will pay the restaurants for the grease.
Wow. So they're clearly making a profit. So a legitimate grease collection business like the one we mentioned, Griffin Industries, one of the larger ones, how does it work?
Well, they operate in some 20 states, and they've got drivers who will go around, daily on rounds to pick up grease. And, you know, how often it go to a particular restaurant depends on how much stuff they're frying. But they'll go around with a tanker truck, and they'll vacuum out the grease in each of the bins. And the tanker truck could hold, say, 5,000 gallons of grease, and that's worth several thousand dollars, and companies like Griffin, this is a big business for them, and the theft is so bad that they've actually hired two full-time detectives. One is a former Texas Ranger, and another is a former policeman in San Antonio, and they do nothing but track grease thefts in different states where they operate.
Wow.
Full-time.
It doesn't seem that hard. Just hire a collie if it smells that bad.
Right.
Who are the thieves? What's a profile of a typical grease thief?
Oh, very daring, like Remington Steele, like a cat burglar. He woos the ladies at night and steals the grease by day.
Right. So I asked that question, too. I was really curious. And one of the detectives said, well, they can run. He's dealt with third-generation grease thieves, so this can kind of run in the family. Lately, sometimes it's newcomers who've been attracted. They want to get into this business because, you know, the price has tripled. There's money to be made. Huh. But the problem is there's no free grease left. So because they can't always get enough contracts to make a go of it, they'll just go to the bins and steal it.
But then when they try to resell it, don't they get caught?
Well, there are these middlemen who are independent grease collectors who all-time operators will...
Put that on my business card.
Right, a grease middleman. Well, so these middlemen will collect it, and then that sort of obscures the origin of the grease, and then they'll sell it to a rendering company. But the rendering companies are kind of getting smart to this, and oftentimes they won't buy from an independent because they figure, well, this is just stolen grease.
Well, it's, I have to say, a kind of a bizarre story. But, Ben, we're glad you reported on it. We're glad you shared it with us. Ben Arnoldi is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. I will never again go to Arby's and not think twice about all that leftover grease that's left in the back. It's making
right.
fuel.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Ben.
Yep.
You'll still use the horsey sauce liberally, but you'll think about it.
The horsey sauce.
I'm definitely writing this grease screenplay, you know. You could have lines. I mean, the lines just write themselves, right? He's a pretty slick operator. He just slipped through our fingers this time, but we'll get him next time. We're the Grease Gang.
Oh, my. So we're going to make a little bit of a turn here at the Bryant Park Project. Going from grease thieves, we're going to talk about a more serious story. We're going to talk about aid. And the problems that aid agencies are facing in trying to get much-needed supplies into Myanmar after this weekend's devastating cyclone. We're going to get an update from one agency that operates in the region. That'll be coming up next here on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Yesterday, we reported on a construction project that could redefine the Las Vegas Strip, the $8 billion city center. It's bringing some of the world's most famous architects to the Strip. Well, today we return to Vegas to hear about the ambitious environmental goals of City Center. The development is trying to follow green building standards, what are called LEED standards, to be precise. But as NPR's Ted Robbins reports, some say getting LEED certification is not worth the cost.
Standing in the midst of construction for the City Center project on the Las Vegas Strip, it's hard to imagine it's conserving anything. 76 acres of soaring and curving hotels, condos, shopping and entertainment space in the desert. But Cindy Ortega touts its sustainability. She is VP of Energy and Environmental Services for MGM Mirage, which owns City Center.
It's beautiful, isn't it? See the curvature of the steel? Now, the reason why this is environmental, you see this guy welding this steel right here? Steel is 95% recycled.
Actually, using recycled steel is common practice. Steel is the most recycled material on the planet. But City Center is even recycling construction waste, including the concrete left over when the old Boardwalk Casino was blown up to make way for the new development.
So instead of hauling it away out to some pile out in the hills out here, we crushed it up on site and reused it for the roads here.
The goal is a green development. The proof is LEED certification. Bill Browning is a founding member of the U.S. Green Building Council, which administers LEED. He helped write the standards.
in the early 90s, we didn't have a good way of defining what was a green building and how could you measure the performance of a building in terms of energy, indoor air quality, how it dealt with the habitat and stormwater.
So the council came up with a point system. The more a builder does to make a development sustainable, the more points the development gets.
The rating has different levels, certified, silver, gold, and platinum.
But to get to platinum, you really have to push.
Less than 20, 30 buildings out of 7,000 in the system have achieved platinum at this point.
The Las Vegas City Center is going for LEED Silver. That means high-efficiency windows, lots of natural light, reclaimed water for landscaping, and an on-site electric generating plant which uses excess heat to warm the buildings. A gold rating would have required much more. Some things which make sense in the desert, some which don't. And with LEED, it's pretty much one size fits all. MGM Mirage Vice President Gordon Apsher.
I was in a meeting one time on City Center where LEED experts were arguing we should pursue rainwater catch basins. And all of these experts in from all over finally were stopped in their tracks when somebody from Las Vegas said, "Folks, it rains 3 inches a year here. Maybe we should move on and talk about something else."
Another criticism of LEED, it gives the same number of points for minor improvements, like installing bike racks, as it does for putting in a costly, energy-efficient heating and cooling system. And regardless of the point score, you have to prove a building is green. Just the process of getting LEED certification can be cumbersome. Bill Browning again.
Yeah, early on, boy, to do the documentation, you wound up with an entire bookshelf of documents. It was just horrific.
In fact, City Center has an office just to fill out LEED paperwork. For this huge complex, that might not be a problem. For a smaller developer, the added $20,000 to $30,000 could be significant. But Bill Browning says a buyer needs proof.
I come out of the real estate development industry, and I know how outrageous people claims about buildings and what I'm doing with this and that and the marketing claims and all that. But when you see that plaque on the wall and you see the point score, you know, that's someone else who's done the paperwork and said, yep, they're actually doing that.
So here's what's happening. LEED standards are being rewritten as we speak. Certification is being streamlined and moved online. Other building organizations are writing their own green building standards, and cities and counties across the country are adapting elements of LEED which fit local conditions. Building to LEED Silver standard at Las Vegas City Center is adding about 2% to upfront construction costs. But MGM Mirage VP Gordon Apsher says energy, waste, and water savings will make that up and more in the long run.
You can make money and do the right thing at the same time.
Right now, building to LEED is voluntary. As costs come down and building codes change, it's possible building green won't be newsworthy, but standard practice. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Government reports from Myanmar suggest the death toll there may be soaring above 22,000 people. Aid groups and donor countries are trying to get assistance to survivors of the devastating cyclone in the country also known as Burma. The United Nations says hundreds of thousands of people are in need of help, but getting visas and travel permission from the country's repressive military government is still a problem. The U.S. is among those trying to provide aid. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports on the complications of the aid effort.
Several days after a powerful cyclone swept through Myanmar, the UN's World Food Program has started to deliver rice it already had stockpiled in the country. WFP's Asia director Tony Banbury said his agency is also just starting to get the access needed to ramp up operations.
We managed to get one visa today. We expect more visas tomorrow. Importantly, the government has accepted a WFP plane to go into Yangon tomorrow with emergency food aid, high energy biscuits. And that was an important test of the government's willingness to accept international assistance. They've agreed to let that plane in, and that's a very good sign.
Speaking by cell phone from Thailand, Banbury said UN teams are trying to assess the situation in the hardest hit area in Myanmar, the Irrawaddy Delta, where entire villages are said to have been destroyed. Banbury said the UN knew well in advance that the storm would hit Myanmar, but no one predicted the scale of the disaster.
there was extensive contingency planning for what it might do in the country and how the UN might respond. I think the destruction of the storm caught everyone by surprise, and the death tolls that are now being talked about, well above 20,000, are catching everyone by surprise, including the government.
While Banbury says he sees signs of cooperation from Myanmar's military rulers, President Bush is trying to test that further. The U.S. is offering more than $3 million now, and President Bush says he wants to do more.
We're prepared to move U.S. Navy assets to help find those who've lost their lives, to help find the missing, and to help stabilize the situation. But in order to do so, the military junta must allow our disaster assessment teams into the country.
The teams are currently in Thailand waiting for visas to go to Myanmar, also known as Burma. Joel Charney of Refugees International isn't optimistic about that, especially since both President Bush and his wife Laura have been so critical of the junta in Myanmar, and the president just today signed legislation giving Burmese opposition figure Aung San Suu Kyi a Congressional Medal of Freedom.
Yeah, we have a mix of political and humanitarian messages, and I think overall the Burmese government is unfortunately unlikely to respond positively to allowing a U.S. team in to assess the situation.
Refugees International is urging the U.S. to play it straight, not look for political openings, but simply respond to the humanitarian crisis. He thinks that will make it more likely that aid groups on the ground will be allowed to expand their operations. Charney was in Myanmar earlier this year to report on the humanitarian situation and says there are 10 U.N. agencies and 48 relief and humanitarian groups already in place.
The government is very controlling, and there are restrictions placed on the agencies, but I think outsiders really do underestimate both the number of agencies and also the scope of their programs. There's international work going on now in practically the entire country. You know, this isn't North Korea, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
He says some of the smaller groups may not have the capacity to respond to the latest emergency, but he says there are plenty of groups the Bush administration could support, even if U.S. aid officials can't get on the ground. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
It's not easy to reach people in Myanmar, and phone lines are not ideal, but we did speak earlier today with Mark Rappaport. He's with the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR.
I'm now in Yangon, and then the town has been devastated. What we hear from others who have made it to the lower part of the delta, just close to Yangon, in the most affected area, the situation is even worse.
Have you had field reports from the hardest hit areas?
What we are learning so far is that the percentage of damage is, you know, between 60 and 80%. Some villages have been wiped off. We rely to a great extent on the assessment of whoever has made it to the area, also the government.
What can you tell us about how aid is actually getting into the country and how it will be distributed once it arrives?
Well, the government has officially welcomed assistance. For the time being, it's not yet clear what is the situation. So what we have done so far, we have contributed some canned food, temporary shelters such as tents, plastic sheeting, and domestic items such as cooking sets or stoves. The needs, of course, are immense.
Mr. Rappaport, do you intend to try to get to the hardest hit region anytime soon?
Yes, we are trying to access those areas, but we are also relying on the other agencies, other UN agencies or Red Cross.
Is the local government there up to this?
Well, so far they say that they are, and they have a national committee that was established, and I trust that they do have logistics network. We will see in the coming days. Of course, this is a complex emergency, and additional international support from my point of view would be needed, so we will do within our limited capacity.
Now, we keep hearing that the death toll in the country, the estimated death toll, keeps rising. It's now estimated to reach perhaps 50,000 people. What's that based on? How are you able to make these kinds of assessments?
Well, that death toll is the one provided by the government. In such situations, many people are missing, so it is a credible death toll, but at this point in time, I mean, our focus is not to count, you know, exactly, but rather to assess needs and see what we can do within the current situation.
All right. Mr. Rapoport, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Mark Rapoport with the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, speaking to us from Myanmar's largest city, Yangon.
It's been a year now since NPR News started a journey around the world. Our series Climate Connections with National Geographic explored how we are changing the planet and how the climate changes us. This morning, the journey is over. It ends in a city that tries to change nothing. It's a city intended to burn no gas or oil, so its contribution to greenhouse gases will be minimal. NPR's Joe Palca visited the site near the Abu Dhabi airport in the Persian Gulf, where the city will be built.
You have to have a good imagination to picture what the spot I'm standing in is going to look like in 10 years. I'm at the edge of what will be a 6-square-kilometer city housing 50,000 people. Right now, it doesn't look like much except a windswept desert.
Imagine.
So to help with our imagination, the people building Masdar have produced this promotional video.
The open spaces are shaded and cool, even during the hottest times of the day. The streets are narrow with high sides and overhangs, providing shade within the city.
Although the buildings will be thoroughly modern, the architects are trying to capture the flavor of an ancient Arabic city. It turns out that copying those old designs will help them reach their ambitious energy goals.
Masdar will be the first city where carbon emissions are zero, where waste is converted to energy and reduced to zero, and 80% of water will be recycled. This is the city of the future.
It certainly sounds convincing, at least the way that slick announcer guy says it. But let's take a closer look.
Masdar will be the first city where carbon emissions are zero.
How do you bring carbon emissions to zero? Well, some of it's common sense. Narrow streets and shaded walks will reduce the need for air conditioning. That isn't rocket science. Some of it will involve new technologies, such as larger and more efficient solar electricity generators. And finally, cars will be banned from the city. So to replace the cars, the city's designers are turning to something called a PRT system, Personal Rapid Transit.
And really all it is a car.
Scott McWiggin is with CH2M Hill, the construction firm that's building Masdar.
It's a simple vehicle, 6 passengers. It's designed like a car, but obviously it's powered by solar energy with batteries.
These solar-powered cars will run under the city, just like a subway system. But the cars won't run on fixed routes. Basically, they'll take you anywhere you want to go.
So you jump into it, there's about 1,500 stations. You program what station you want to go to, and it will directly take you to that station. You know, if you look at things like Blade Runner, etc., it's really bringing that to the fore now.
So PRTs and solar get you part of the way to zero carbon. Now let's look at some of the other claims made by that oh-so-slick announcer guy.
And 80% of water will be recycled.
Saving water is critical because it takes energy to make water in Masdar. You have to convert salty water from the Gulf into fresh water. But saving water means changing business as usual.
We have a fairly linear process normally. We kind of take water in through the tap, we use it, and then it goes straight in the drain. So it gets used once.
Peter Sherritt is with WSP, a British energy consulting firm. The plan at Masdar will be to reuse water as many times as possible. One idea involves capturing whatever's left after you water adjacent farm fields and parks.
So when you put the water onto the ground, when it has gone through the kind of top 2-3 feet and has actually met the needs and requirements of the plant, there are then collection systems embedded in the below ground to recover that.
The water can then be used to irrigate another day, or whatever else it's needed for. So that's the plan for conserving water. What about that other claim, no waste at all?
Masdar will be the first city where waste is converted to energy and reduced to zero.
When they say reduced to zero, in reality it'll be reduced to very close to zero, since some stuff just can't be converted to energy or recycled. But when it comes to, how can I put this delicately, human waste, Peter Sherritt says that will all be repurposed.
To recover those nutrients and actually use them to create soil, which can then be used as part of the landscaping, and also a component of the sewage sludge will again go for a waste-to-power scheme.
The strategy to reuse or recycle as much as possible permeates the planning for Masdar. Construction manager Scott McWiggin says it's a bit of a game, always looking for materials that can be reused. Take the fencing around the construction site.
We're looking at recyclable plastic for site fencing. And at the end of that, we can sell that back to the manufacturer. He can recycle that or resell that on again. So it has a useful life at the end of our life that we are using it for.
They've even begun to think about how to recycle the concrete used to build Masdar. And that's before the first building's even finished. Now, remember how we started out exploring the claims of Masdar City.
Masdar will be the first city where carbon emissions are zero.
The idea is to build a city that will have no carbon footprint. But obviously, because a lot of construction equipment uses gas, there's going to be some CO2 going into the atmosphere. The planners say they'll offset that by planting trees or putting surplus solar energy back into the Abu Dhabi power grid. But calculating your carbon footprint is trickier than just measuring how much diesel fuel you burn. Liz Darley is with the British firm BioRegional. Her job is to oversee Masdar's carbon calculations. When my producer Rebecca Davis and I visited her in London, she pointed out there are a lot of things you could include in the carbon footprint.
What they're currently doing is deciding where that boundary is drawn, and that is in itself quite a complex thing to decide on as a project team, because it could include all the carbon expenditure of flying between Europe and the Middle East that the design team is incurring. It could go to the extent of you guys coming here to interview us. Once you start peeling back the layers of the onion, it just goes on and on and on forever.
So achieving the goal of being a zero carbon city can be made easy or very, very hard, depending on where you draw your boundaries. Skeptics say reducing Masdar's total carbon footprint to zero will be difficult, if not impossible. And besides, they say, Masdar City is only 50,000 people. The millions of others living in the United Arab Emirates are still guzzling gas like, well, like we are in this country. Khaled Awad is in charge of turning the plans for Masdar City into a reality. He's heard the skeptics, but to them, he says, bring it on. Tell us where we can make improvements in our plans, and we'll make them.
Look, we're serious about this. We're going to put so much resources to do it right. And this is the ideal place where you can demonstrate what you believe in a scale that will make it a meaningful scale.
This is not a single building or just a neighborhood. It's a city of 50,000 people. The plan is to build Masdar City in record time. The first building should be up by the end of the summer. Will it meet its ambitious energy goals? Maybe. But even the skeptics admit it's worth a try. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Masdar. Shahidun. على حياة المستقبل العصرية.
To see a fly-through animation of how city planners envision Masdar City, visit npr.org/climateconnections, where you can also find all the stories in this series and videos from public television's Wild Chronicles. The builders of a brand new city want to make their mark on the world by making no mark at all. The city is in the desert near the Persian Gulf, in the oil-producing state of Abu Dhabi. And if you believe the promotional video, the city will have no carbon footprint.
Imagine.
Abu Dhabi imagines an entire city that releases no greenhouse gas.
Imagine a place where the challenge of living in an extreme climate is overcome at no cost to the environment.
The place is called Masdar City. When it's built, and Abu Dhabi has the money to build it, it's supposed to have 50,000 inhabitants. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca went there for our series Climate Connections with National Geographic. And Joe, how did this project get started?
Well, the leaders of Abu Dhabi wanted to get into the alternative energy field, and they looked around the world to see where there was the Silicon Valley of alternative energy, and there wasn't one. So they said, okay, we'll build it here.
And I suppose they got plenty of silicon since it's in the middle of the desert. Yep. But setting that aside for a moment, why would Abu Dhabi, which is part of the United Arab Emirates, which has something like 10% of the world's oil reserves, get into the subject of carbon footprints and alternative energy?
Yeah, I mean, it's the obvious question, Steve. And I was going to ask Sultan Al-Jaber, who's the CEO of Masdar Initiative, exactly that. As I say, I was going to ask him, but he beat me to it.
Why is Abu Dhabi doing this? The answer is very simple. Number one, because we can. Number two, because we should. and because we believe that there's a natural extension for our involvement in the energy markets.
A natural extension for Abu Dhabi's energy industry? Does he mean when the oil runs out, they want to be able to do something else?
Yeah, imagine thinking that far in advance. But that's what they say they're doing. But there is another reason, Steve.
Abu Dhabi wanted to show that it's aware of its carbon footprint today.
So that's Khaled Awad. He's this Lebanese-trained engineer. He's the guy who's in charge of building the city. He's the first one there in the morning and the last one to leave at the end of the day.
We thought this is an ideal opportunity, I mean, for an oil producer to try to become a leader in renewable energy and sustainability was something really fascinating.
Fascinating if you have the money to do it.
Yeah, and they do. I mean, as you said, this is an oil-producing nation. They're making a lot of money, and they've taken $4 billion in cash, and they're planning to raise another $18 billion. And Khaled says it's a very calculated decision to spend this much on this Masdar city.
I think this is exactly what we wanted to do, is to show people that, look, we're serious about this. We're going to put so much resources to do it right, and we want you to come and join us there, and then they will start doing it with us.
So every time we put $3.50 gas in our SUVs, a little slice of it maybe going back to Abu Dhabi and building this sustainable city, and how much interest is it generating around the world?
Well, it is getting quite a bit of interest. One of the first people to get on board with this was the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. They get a lot of people say, we want to partner with you, but MIT was interested in this whole renewability thing. So they're helping Masdar make an institute that will do renewable energy. And they've also got a lot of attention from architects. Foster and Partners in England is one of the firms that's involved. They've designed the initial plans for Masdar. You know, I talked to this Nader Ardalan. He's an architect and a professor of architecture at Harvard. And he understands that Abu Dhabi would like to do something about its carbon footprint. And he says Masdar City is a start.
This is really an experimental town. It's a little town. It has 50,000 people in Abu Dhabi, which is, growing to be past a million people. This is a drop in the bucket, but this is a very important, precious drop.
And Ardalan says he understands why an oil-rich country would want to do this kind of project.
The people in oil-producing world want to be considered in a different light. They want to not be viewed as Bedouins. They want to be viewed as people of conscience and of education.
Although I guess they have to now figure out what that looks like physically when you build a brand new city from scratch in the desert.
Right, right. And the interesting thing is that Ardalan says, you know, it's going to help Abu Dhabi, but it's also going to help people in the West.
Because many of us are being invited to design these buildings, and from these, whether they're successful and some mistakes will be made, we'll be able to learn a lot. And I think we can then transfer this back to America, which is sort of funny, because normally the transfer has been American technology, Western technology going to the East.
That's one of many architects intrigued by a plan to build a brand new city in the desert in the Persian Gulf state of Abu Dhabi. And Joe Palca, I'd like to know, if you get in a taxi, if you say, take me to Masdar City right now, what do you see?
Well, the first thing, the taxi gets lost because there's nothing to see yet. That's what happened to us anyway. But when you do get there, it's just basically a sign and a couple of construction trailers. But even when you see the construction trailers, you know it's something different, because instead of just a bunch of trailers sitting next to a vacant lot, it's got this giant tent over it. Why a tent? Well, they can save about 10 degrees of cooling because it's cooler inside these construction trailers simply because of the tent.
The construction trailers are cooler because there's this shield over them, basically.
Exactly. The other thing that's kind of interesting, and the tent is a good example of this, is that they are taking old-fashioned approaches to solving these modern problems. So even though the city itself will be completely modern, it won't look that different, because when they went to build it, they realized that people in the Middle East had already figured out some of these ways to save energy. I talked with this guy, Peter Sharrett. He's an energy consultant with the British firm called WSP, and it's one of the firms responsible for doing the design work at Masdar.
The visible part of the city is really a reinterpretation of an Arab town. The streets are narrow, they reflect and diffuse direct sunlight, they create shaded areas, we create microclimates by using water, we create areas where people can walk in a very hot environment. The bits then that you don't see so much of, those are what we call the clever technologies, the energy systems, the distributions, the networks that make all of the city hang together.
So what Sherratt's saying is they're going to use traditional methods to make a livable city in a beastly hot environment, but they're going to use some really clever technologies, too.
What sort of clever technologies?
Well, I'm going to talk more about that in tomorrow's story, but I'll tell you about one today. It's called the Personal Rapid Transit System. It's a kind of a public transport, but instead of buses with fixed routes and gas engines, these are pods, solar-powered pods. Have you seen the Jetsons?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so it's like the Jetsons. You get into one of these pods, you punch in your destination, and off you go.
How can that save energy, though, if people are going individually in different places?
Well, solar-powered, more efficient. You don't need to fill up a whole bus for getting three people across town. Makes more sense.
Or even have a gas-guzzling taxi cab, for that matter.
You got it.
NPR's Joe Palca will be listening for more tomorrow. Thanks.
I'll be here.
The efficient way to keep up on climate change is to listen to Morning Edition from NPR News. You can read our year-long series on the effects of climate change at npr.org/climateconnections.